appreciate your willingness to make this adjustment in your schedule. As you have inferred from what we're doing, we have a lot more things to do than we have time to do, so I'm glad to be able to make up that session that we lost due to my inability to be here. Let's return to what we were doing here as quickly as possible. Moving on to a possible inference, I don't know whether we ought to... let's look at one more passage, because I think this passage is less controversial, and that is the passage in Matthew. And by the way, the Gospel of Matthew is full of the use of the word plero. So it's use of the term over and over again. Let's look at two passages. They're important enough to look at, I think. The one that is not very controversial has to do with 2:14 and 15. This relates to the flight of the Holy Family to Egypt and then their return from Egypt. In 14 we're told, he rose, took the child and his mother by night, departed to Egypt, remained there until the death of Herod. This was to fulfill what the Lord had spoken by the prophet, "Out of Egypt have I called my son." Now, here again, when you have a verb that has to be translated in the past tense, or even in the present tense, when that present is past with regard to the reference that you're examining, chances are you're looking at an historical event that's being described. And sure enough, when you go back to Hosea, chapter 11 and verse 1, you find, "When Israel was a child, I loved him, and out of Egypt I called my son." Hosea is talking about the Exodus. And this statement is certainly not a prediction of the return of the Holy Family from Egypt. It's simply saying that there is a parallel, there's a correspondence, and there's an escalation. You want to find the highest event where God called his son from Egypt, you find it in the Incarnation. See? Now, another one that's more controversial. Yes, sir.
You go through that one more time, how you said that. You're saying this is really not referring to...
No, it's to 11:1 of Hosea.
Right.
No, it is referring to that, okay. But not as a prediction. The fulfillment doesn't mean that Hosea 11:1 was a prediction, which is then realized with regard to the return of the Holy Family from Egypt, but rather is a statement about the Exodus, which is filled full of meaning in this corresponding event, which culminates a great act of deliverance. No, this matter, not only sparing him from Herod's wrath, but bringing the family also back from Egypt, where they might have gotten lost somewhere. And of course, that would have undermined the Incarnation. Follow me?
I think I do, but I don't want to waste the time right now.
Okay, talk with me about it, Paul, and I'll see what your questions are on it. Now, let's take a little more controversial one, but here again, it makes a world of difference in exegesis. And that is the one in Matthew 1:22 and 23. This matter involving Joseph and the angel and the statement about what happened. All of this took place to fulfill what the Lord had spoken by the prophet, "Behold, a virgin shall conceive and bear a son, and his name shall be called Emmanuel." Now, that's going to relate to a third possibility here, which is closely related to this one, and that is what I have in this line of reasoning. If fulfillment can be used of a past prediction which was already realized in the past. And when you look at the statement in Isaiah 7, which is addressed to Ahaz, I won't take the time to turn to that, but you might turn to it. And when you find there Isaiah's statement to Ahaz concerning a sign that Ahaz will see, which ought to support what the prophet is telling him, it's obvious that he's telling him something about a child that's going to be born within Isaiah's and Ahaz's lifetime. Now, by the way, the Hebrew word there is not virgin, but young maiden, could be a young married maiden. And I won't trace the inferential reasoning, but I'm sure it was a young married maiden back there. But now the New Testament, using the Septuagint, makes of that young married maiden a virgin. Just as John makes of what appears to be a synonymous parallelism, a synthetic one. Using it in a changed way in order to indicate the highest expression of the sign of God. That what God is saying is true, namely Emmanuel, God with us, born of a virgin. And since, if there can be an escalated realization in the Christ event when viewed in retrospect, I don't believe in double meanings of the text. Now there's a tremendous hermeneutical argument, including such people as James Smart and Marcus Barth, the son of Karl Barth, etc., who say that we ought to look not only for the recreation of the writer's intent. I don't think Isaiah had any idea of the Messiah when he was talking to Ahaz in Isaiah 7. But we ought to look behind that in terms of God's intent. Well, the moment you start trying to read the mind of God, you are in trouble, big trouble. I mean, if and when the New Testament writers do it, fine. They had special inspiration. Fine, we accept that. We see what they do. But I don't think we'd better try to duplicate that. Otherwise, there are no controls. No controls whatsoever. So, I said that in my first chapter, by the way, in hermeneutics, addressing that concept that interpretation is more than recreation. Remember, we emphasized in the Thought of Bible study that interpretation is essentially recreation of the author's meaning. What did the author mean and intend when these words were written? How they were they understood by the people who read them? That grammatical, historical, literary meaning. It would follow that fulfillment may relate, in some cases, to the fullest realization of a past prediction which was already realized on a lesser level. See? That's what fulfill means in this case. So, now let me move to the summary format, and I remind you now that we talked about three or four stages, depending on how you divide them up. The inferential reasoning stage, with these specific lines of reasoning, which is what we've been doing. Then the summary format, if two or more possibilities emerge. And I would say, with regard to fulfillment, that two major possibilities emerge with regard to what the meaning of Psalm 22:18 is and in what sense it is fulfilled. And by the way, although the synoptic writers don't use fulfill, they, in connection with this, the use of this, the allusion to this verse, I think essentially that's what they mean by it. John does use it. One has to do with a non-predictive understanding of Psalm 22 event, 18 as a past event in the life of the psalmist or someone in the past. An Old Testament event to which the crucifixion corresponds in an escalated way. And then you get the supporting evidence. And we've seen that evidence. And by the way, the evidence would point to the concept that the major correspondence has to do with the fact that just as in Psalm 22 and other psalms of lament, some of which Woody mentioned in his report, have to do with the lament of a righteous person who is being persecuted unjustly by the wicked and is not delivered by God as he would expect to be. That's when you come to the crux interpretationis of Psalm 22, that is it. See? That's why he's so dismayed. I mean, you're treating me like a sin. God, you're forsaking me. You're supposed to be delivering the righteous just as you delivered the fathers. You know. Now, the other is predictive. So this is non-predictive. The other is predictive. And that involves two possibilities. I put a dotted line. They're both predictive possibilities. And some of the evidence that supports one supports the other. By the way, I think when you evaluate the evidence, I think this is this is what it kind of turns out to be. I don't think this statement is predictive at all. But these are the other possibilities that have emerged in terms of following certain lines of reasoning. A prediction which is realized solely, this is the only realization, this is what it is predicting, in the crucifixion of Jesus. Or a prediction which came to pass previously, but which had its highest culmination in the crucifixion of Jesus. We've given you examples of all three of these. Are we clear on that? Now, as I say, without rehashing the evidence and the influential reasoning we've used and much that we could use that we haven't used, it seems to me that when you weigh it, it weighs pretty heavily on this side, beginning with the pronouns and the tense of the verbs, etc. Past deliverance, which issues and praise, etc. So I think it weighs very heavily here. But you see how fulfilled can be used in this way. And by the way, there's not complete correspondence. Some of you indicated exact correspondence, not complete correspondence. In fact, I got a kick out of a noted scholar who takes the messianic view, you know, one of these predictive views. And he goes through the psalm and points out the correspondences, and he says with regard to the fact that the psalmist says, my hands and feet were pierced. Jesus' hands were pierced and his feet, or maybe his feet were tied. Well, chances are they were tied. The evidence strongly favors the tying of the feet and the nailing of the hands. But that didn't faze that commentator at all. I mean, he adds that aside. He recognizes that there's a flaw in his argument, but he acts as if there is no flaw and sees this perfect prediction of the Messiah. Anyway, we all have our quirks, so we won't. I'm not trying to pick on that commentary, but that's what happens, talking about the selective kind of thing, you see. That's what happens when you make up your mind that this is going to be a prediction which is fulfilled in Christ, and then you come across a piece of evidence that doesn't quite fit, but you sort of shrug it off. It seems to me that you have a lot of correspondence, not absolute correspondence, but a lot of correspondence, obviously. And even if this statement is figurative, even if it is figurative, and I have another summary format with, is the statement literal or figurative, synonymous parallelism or synthetic parallelism, etc. Those are the major issues we have to try to deal with. Even if it is figurative, that it should be fulfilled in the degree it is, literally, in the crucifixion of Christ, would have had tremendous significance for the Jews. Because, as you know, in rabbinical exegesis, they were constantly looking for evidences of correlation between the Old Covenant and the New Covenant. Because, to their mind, that correlation was demonstration that God was behind it. After all, take the experience of the psalmist, whatever it was. There are 1,001 ways in which he might have described his experience. Why did he describe it in this particular way, and especially if it's David, who of course is not lineage of the Messiah, when you end up with this high degree of correlation between the description of the psalmist and the crucifixion of Jesus? This, to the mind of the Jew, would indicate divine inspiration, superintendence, and genuine proof, substantiation, that Jesus was indeed the Messiah. He was fulfilling the old covenant. See, this is one of those what C.H. Dodd calls testimonia from the Old Testament concerning the messiahship of Jesus, and that's why John develops it so much. Maybe beyond what it ought to be developed, but in any case, develops it so much because of the significance of that to the, especially to the Jewish mind. Well. I think we've gone through the other stages here, at least suggestively, in terms of evaluation and conclusion. This is where I tend to come down for, and I've given you a number of the reasons here. So that's the process. I suppose I ought to stop and ask, in spite of the fact that we're pressed for time. Do you have any questions now, particularly about the methodology? That's our primary concern, not so much what we end up with on this passage, although in some ways the two are bound together, but particularly the methodology. Are we clear at that point? Are you ready for another go at it with regard to tongues in 1 Corinthians 14? Any questions on the methodology, Woody?
On the methodology, it concerns one of the premises in the beginning, one of the first ones. Where exactly do you see the psalmist, the answer for the psalmist 22 that you just heard?
Well, the statement of verse 24 really is the statement that harkens back to the answer.
So it changes from first person to third person.
But the hymn could well be the psalmist. See, in fact, in the context, it would be the psalmist. So there's no other referent. There's no other antecedent for him.
Just the afflicted as an abstract person. No particular, but thank God, always hears the one who's afflicted.
Yeah, but in this context, who's afflicted? See, when I talk about the afflicted one in this context, the afflicted one is the psalmist.
He's reviewing history and other instances where God has answered.
Yeah, but why does he introduce this in this psalm? It's not germane to the psalm if he takes off another motif just because it's historical, you say.
What I'm trying to get to is it possible that he's making a statement of faith? Can we develop reasoning with that and go in a completely different direction?
Well, you'd have some trouble with the tense of the verb.
Which verb?
Has. He has not. He has. Not will. The statement of faith is will.
The statement he's basing, of... saying that he's basing his view on the fact that God has heard in the past on other people.
Yeah, but...
In other cases, other instances, he has heard that prior to the afflicted.
But that doesn't give him a basis for saying, I will tell to my brethren in the midst of congregation, I will praise thee, not after what you have in this psalm before.
It's lament.
Well, I think the burden of proof would be on you.
That's what I want to know. How possible is that?
What you have to do is lay out your inferential reasoning and let's look at it. You know, the premise is true and is the reasoning valid? That's the only way to do it. But I think what that does is to take really this thing out of this context and put it in a more abstract, generalized context. And then, as I, you're really viewing the use of the perfect and the past tense in terms of the certainty of the future. That's what you're really saying. And that's a possible use. But that's the unusual use, very unusual use. And the fact that you have in Greek and Syriac texts, thou hast answered me. There, you see what was being done, saying something is missing here, and let's apply it to make sense. Well, it wasn't in the original psalm, but I think the evidence would tend to be in favor of the position that we have expressed here. That this goes back to what we did in our survey. How accurate that survey is, and of course that the survey is tentative and has to be supported by evidence. And if, but I would be interested in, you know, I've lined up my reasoning, so let's line up yours, and we won't take the time to do it here, and let's look at it. That's the only way to do it. That's the inductive way to do it. And you may be right. I'm not saying you aren't, but I have serious doubts about the viability of that view in contrast to the evidence, which would seem to support the other view. And by the way, our discussion here really involves inferential reasoning. So that's this. By the way, this is the rebuttal, the debate kind of thing. You say that's involved here, and what lies behind it is inferential reasoning, and that's why I say what we need to do is lay it out. Michael,
I think because we've gone through this kind of quickly, I'm not sure if I understand the supporting evidence or reasoning to make the distinction between the first possibility and the third.
Well, I gave you examples of all of these. The first of these possibilities had to do with the example I gave you from John 12, for example, which goes back to Isaiah 53 and then Isaiah 6. Now 53 is more controversial and less clear. Isaiah 6 is very clear. We know that the statement there is about the people in Isaiah's time to whom Isaiah was going to preach. Here, and it's not a statement of Isaiah 6. In fact, I don't think there's a statement of Isaiah 53 is predictive, just a description of the event back there, which then corresponds to the unbelieving people who respond to Christ, the suffering servant of Yahweh. I mean, he's the ultimate suffering servant of Yahweh.
Okay, so in the third possibility, then, there is going to be some sort of indication that it is a prediction.
Yeah, that you would have a clear prediction. And I gave you an illustration there, the statement about the virgin shall conceive. There's a prediction in Isaiah 7, which in its context, I think one can argue very strongly, involves a sign that took place in Ahaz's lifetime, because it was supposed to be a sign for Ahaz. There's no point talking about the Messiah for Ahaz as a sign as to what Ahaz ought to believe. So we have a past realization, but not the highest realization of the greatest sign. So this, the difference between them is this is a non-predictive statement, a description of past event. This is a predictive statement.
I guess I'm wondering then where the evidence, I think I must have missed the evidence in Psalm 22 then, to support possibility number 3.
I don't think there's much strong support for it. The support comes from one, the use of fulfill in John 19, as we.
So you're looking to the New Testament rather.
Yeah, reading this Old Testament statement in light of the New Testament, which is all right to do. I mean, we ought to, if the New Testament interprets or uses Old Testament statements, we ought to look at what those uses and interpretations are and try to incorporate them into our reasoning with regard to interpreting the Old Testament event. That tends to beg the question with regard to what fulfill means. You argue that fulfill means a prediction, and John uses fulfill, therefore John is interpreting the statement of Psalm 22 as a prediction which is realized or actualized in Christ, then you have this line of reasoning, but you beg the question as to what fulfill means. And what I'm saying is that fulfill has a variety of possibilities. These three, two involve predictive use, the other is non-predictive. And you have to ask yourself in each case which use is found here.
Would that parallel when Jesus used the term of fulfilling Scripture? He didn't come to do away with it, but fulfill it.
Well, that's another proposition. That's what my book is all about. I'm going to go through the whole process. Observation, asking questions.
I just want to jump in. Use that term, brother.
Actually, what you have there is something of a predictive use in the sense that the Old Testament is forward-looking. You have a relationship of preparation and fulfillment. So the Old Testament looks forward to the New Testament. The New Testament fills it full. In fact, we'll get into that as we move into evaluation application. One of the reasons why you have to evaluate, particularly statements of the Old Testament, is because of this movement between the two covenants. So we'll be getting into that. So it's a modification of really this first use in terms of preparation and realization.
So what you're saying then that the Old Testament actually has already laid down the New Testament. It's already been laid down, and then the New Testament actually fills in. What already exists?
It prepares for the fulfillment.
I'm just trying to get my thinking.
Yeah, I don't think fulfill means that the New Testament fulfills the Old Testament, means that the New Testament is in the Old Testament. And all you have to do.
I didn't mean that way. I meant like if I said, I'm going to set a bucket across the street. And tomorrow the bucket's there, and you come and you. I'm going to set a bucket to hold water across the street. Tomorrow you come in and say, you put water in. You say, I fulfill what I've said. I meant in that context.
Yeah, that's Of course, you have promises. Part of the preparation in the Old Testament is promises of the coming Messiah, which, of course, Jesus actualizes. That's the simplest part of it. But you also have certain purposes. The Old Covenant existed for certain purposes which could not be realized by the Old Covenant. In fact, the Old Covenant failed to make for a righteous people of God, a holy nation. But Christ realizes, actualizes the purpose of the Old Covenant. Now, some take it to mean fills it full of meaning, which is very doubtful in my mind in context because, for example, Jesus, I don't know how much time we might as well spend time on that. We don't have time to do much of anything else. But if you have particularization in that portion of the Sermon on the Mount, beginning with 5:17 following, 5:17 to 20, the general statement, and then a number of particulars. Now, you have heard it said of old, but I say unto you, etc. When you look at, and when you try to interpret the general statement with regard to Jesus fulfilling the law and the prophets, not destroying them, you find that they don't mean that he took the meaning of the Old Covenant itself and gave a fuller meaning. No. In other words, in the Old Covenant,
you found... You're not going to eisegete Old Testament, I see. Am I thinking right?
Well, the person who says that wouldn't say eisegete. The person would say, using fulfilling in terms of this basic sense I alluded to, and that is, when you look at the Old Covenant, you find only part of the meaning of God's... of the kingdom of God, which is what the Matthew statement is about, you see. As described in particularly in the law. Well, that's law and prophets, but he deals primarily with law, although elsewhere he deals with prophets, as we saw in his statement in Matthew 1, where he fulfilled what Isaiah the prophet said. But primarily he addresses law, and what they would say is that from the Old Covenant we see only the partial meaning of the law. When we come to the New Covenant, we see the full meaning of it. Jesus fills this law full to the brim. That's the literal meaning, the root meaning of fulfill. Fills it full to the brim. Well, for example, that would mean that Jesus, say, takes the law on murder that you have in the Old Covenant. And Jesus goes on to say, implicitly, now I agree that you shouldn't murder. But I would add that you shouldn't be angry at someone. You should not have the kind of dispositions. This, of course, murder is an overt act. Disposition is an inner kind of thing. You should not have the kind of disposition which leads to the overt act of murder. Or you shouldn't have contempt for people. You shouldn't say that, no, that person is a moron. You see. Contempt for people lies at the heart of them treating their lives cheaply. Okay. But now to say that in the Old Testament law on murder, you only had part of its meaning because it had to do with physical murder. Now Jesus says, well, that's only part of the meaning of that commandment. I'm going to tell you the full meaning. And that is this. I say is not true. That commandment was never intended to address the issue of anger. You realize, don't you, that commandment had capital punishment associated with it. So that the commandment was broken. There went the person's life. No way that Moses and the other, that was the whole thing adjudicated by human beings, no way that Moses and the judges that he appointed would go around saying, I know you're angry, and that anger might lead to murder. So we'll meet at sunrise tomorrow, and your life will be gone. That's not the meaning of that commandment. Jesus goes beyond the law. You see. He doesn't give us the fullest meaning of the law. He goes beyond the law. He goes to something that ultimately transcends law, as a matter of fact. And that's what we'll be getting into as we get into this evaluation application, and especially the love ethic. Although it draws upon the law, what he says in Matthew 22 about the summary of the law and the prophets, love the Lord your God with all your heart, soul, strength, and mind, and your neighbors yourself. It comes from the law. It comes from the Shema of Deuteronomy 26, and the statement of Leviticus 19:18 with regard to loving your neighbor as yourself, but it's a higher version. It's the law, what Paul calls the law of Christ, not the law of Moses, the law of Christ. Because, of course, ultimately, he goes on to add with regard to that second one. Not only that if you love God with all your heart, soul, strength, and mind, you love me. The Old Testament never envisioned that there would be an incarnate Messiah whom you ought to love in the same way as you love God the Father. Of course, that's why they didn't buy that. But love one another as I have loved you. That transcends anything you have in the Old Covenant, and especially if you see it in light of the crucifixion, to which there's no parallel in the Old Covenant, no matter how much God suffers back there. God does suffer back there, but never in terms of what you have at the crucifixion. So I'm giving you inferential reasoning as to why, on the basis of context and a number of other things, on scriptural testimony, etc., I would not buy that understanding of Plato in Matthew 5:17.
Don't you also have this idea, kind of dealing with Deuteronomy 30 that we did? And I was thinking, in light of when I took Minor Prophets, dealing with, say, the end of Amos, where there's an aspect, and you dealt with it in Mark, in regard to Mark 7, where Jesus, even fulfilling the law, I don't want to say breaks the law, but in a legal, technical sense, violates the law by changing it.
Well, he does break the law.
Yeah.
He does break the law, because the law is, people, in fact, I had someone walk out on me once when I was doing a Bible study, because the person became so upset, because I said that Christ broke the Mosaic law. He sure did. The Mosaic law, and of course the comeback is, when you tell them what the incidents are, for example, he touched a leper. Now, that breaks the laws of cleanness and uncleanness in Leviticus 11-15. He broke the Sabbath day, asked the person to carry a burden. That was a break in the law. They say, well, he kept the spirit of the law. Well, the law is not merely spirit. It does have spirit behind it, as Deuteronomy so well points out. But the law is a code, is a legal code. It's the law is the letter, too. And Jesus broke the letter. In fact, he did things that would bring capital punishment if the law was carried out. Breaking the Sabbath was one of those things, you see. But here's the paradox, you see. You have to have this continuity in order to have this ultimate continuity in terms of fulfillment. If you simply have more of the same, you don't fulfill it. See. More of this, if Jesus simply presents more law, that's this kind of thing. Fulfillment means transcendence, supersession, superiority, etc. But here we're anticipating what we'll get into when we talk about this matter of needing to evaluate the scripture and how we view the authority of the Old Testament as part of the canon, etc. And that's what we will start in doing, I promise you, on tomorrow. But if you have questions, I'd be glad to talk with you individually, or if you want, we can set up an extra session or two, a voluntary session or two. If you have methodological questions, especially, and would like to have them clarified, I'd be glad to see if we can get together and set a time and address ourselves to methodological questions. Okay, thank you. I appreciate your changing your schedule and taking this time, and we'll see you tomorrow and move on to evaluation and application. Yeah, thank you.